the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Alex Wright, Programmatic and Platform Leader at Channel 4. Hello to you, Alex.
Hello, nice to see you.
Wonderful to have you. And also joining us is ExchangeWire CEO, Rachel Smith. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Alex.
Looking forward to the conversation today. Should be a good one. We'll dive straight into it with the news that digital video is expected to account for over half of total view time by adults in the US, overtaking linear TV for the first time. Watching content on platforms such as YouTube, Netflix, and TikTok is set to account for 52% of total viewing, according to analysis from Insider Intelligence. Average digital viewing time sits at 3 hours and 11 minutes, with Netflix and YouTube each accounting for 33 minutes of view time on average. Findings note that an overall growth in viewership across devices and the increasing use of streaming platforms to show live sports have contributed to this shift. They anticipate that this trend will continue thanks to the popularity of social and video streaming among teenagers. So my first question to you guys is, are we witnessing the end or simply an evolution of linear TV? Alex, let's start with you.
Yes, I don't think it's the end of linear TV. I think we've been saying that for about 10 years now, haven't we? Still the vast, you know, where the vast majority of our views take place is still on our linear channel at Channel 4. However, obviously, there has been this shift coming for quite a long time in media consumption, and the TV landscape is changing. There's a lot of new entrants coming into the market. I'm personally a big fan of streaming myself. I have every subscription you can possibly have, but I also still am, you know, a big watcher of traditional linear as well. I think that I'm coming to this from a very UK-centric and, you know, UK BVOD perspective. So, and the UK and the US media landscape, I think, is quite different. So we do, you know, we are seeing a decline in linear viewing taking place in the UK. But something that's not mentioned in this article is BVOD. And so although there might be a decline in linear viewing for the big broadcasters, there's significant growth happening on their BVOD platforms. So that's something that hasn't been addressed in this article, and it's where we're putting all of our, obviously, focus and attention. We have our Future Force strategy. We announced it in 2020. So for the first time, we are prioritising digital growth over linear ratings. So we know the change is coming, but hopefully we're also moving with that change ourselves.
Rachel, what are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because interesting point that you raised there, Alex, that there's no mention of the BVOD market and what growth looks like in that part of the market. I think that this article reminds us all again as well about how vast the sort of differences in understanding different types of TV sort of consumption are from market to market, because even just the idea that, you know, video consumption in the US is also considered, you know, YouTube, TikTok, short form platforms, to me just sort of slightly skews these results a bit. So, you know, am I surprised by a shift away from linear TV to other platforms? No, I'm not. But do I think that that spells the death of linear TV? Absolutely not, for all of the reasons that you just said, Alex, but also too because I think this is more a story of the type of content that people are consuming and the places that they're consuming that content in. So, you know, it's not necessarily about linear TV is traditional broadcasters of those linear TV TV shows is not a format that I see going anywhere anytime soon. You know, people, there's still a huge audience that's very locked into the series, the, you know, 50 minute TV show of some description, whether it's one-off documentary, whatever, reality TV, live sport, all of the sort of stuff that you routinely consume in a linear TV environment. And I think the BVOD element is what's really interesting because it's now just talking about where people go to get that content. It's not that the content is less popular. It's not that, short form content is becoming more popular. It's just that those platforms are accessible in a completely different way to a different demographic. And that's why I think you're seeing the statistics of the way people are consuming that content increase. And I think the other thing is that, you know, content providers I imagine, exactly as you just said, Alex, at Channel 4, are catering for that shift, right? You know, you'll be spending your time completely embedded in the data that comes back to you in terms of what your viewership looks like, what the demographic of your viewership looks like, what programs are popular, and where people can go to find those programs. And so I therefore think there's just a world of difference between watching linear TV, streaming something on BVOD, streaming something on Netflix, and consuming short-form content on your mobile phone via TikTok or other platforms, YouTube even. I just think these are not necessarily directly comparable things. It's a really interesting stat. It tells us something, but it doesn't give us the whole picture.
No. Yeah, I agree to that point as well, is that, you know, the broadcasters and more traditional platforms are shifting with this. And, you know, we know that the young audiences are going to be consuming content in a different way to what we did. And so, you know, recently we went into partnership with Google where we've actually given them 1,000 hours of long form content to go onto YouTube, because we want to capture those young viewers where they happen to be viewing. And so they're still going to be watching Channel 4 content. It's just going to be on a different platform. So that's just something that, you know, that's just demonstrating that the shift in attitude is there as well from the broadcasters.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, if you think about your own habits, and, you know, I think it's true that probably our TV and video consumption contains that short form content and maybe some social media platform content. But it's just so totally different. So I might be in Instagram and find myself watching tiny snippets of Friends episodes, but it's not the same as sitting down and watching Friends. It's just not the same at all. And so for me, in my mind, that is a different piece of entertainment and a different entertainment activity. And I actually think, because this article also talks about live sports broadcasting, and I think that's one of those things that brings my mind back to the idea that there is some elements of the type of viewing experience that linear TV gives us that will never go away. And live sports is one of those. You think about global events like the Olympics or a World Cup or whatever, nothing can replace that live action and the notion that you're watching this and consuming this with a whole bunch of other people all around the world at the same time, right? That's so powerful. I had a really interesting conversation with someone earlier this week here in APAC that runs a e-commerce platform called Doraz, and their main markets are in South Asia. So you're talking about Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, all of which are really big cricket watching populations. And they've now, on their e-com platform, which is very much like a sort of Amazon style platform, are now actually streaming live sport content for cricket on that platform because they know that's what their audience demographic is super engaged with. So I think that those sorts of things that I sort of made me think when reading this article that it's a much bigger story. It's not just about where the eyeballs are going. It's about how content providers, broadcasters, and content owners are making that content available.
Yeah, definitely. And at the end of the day, we are still only talking, it's 2 hours, you know, according to the data, it's 2 hours and 55 minutes for linear and 3 hours. We're talking about 60 minutes difference here. It's not as if linear has completely fallen off a cliff. And I think there are, you know, wider trends as well to consider. Obviously, we're talking a lot about the kind of subscription saturation in SVOD, and that can obviously affect the trend in terms of linear and BVOD viewing. How do you think kind of those trends are going to affect that evolution and how you know content is consumed over linear and BVOD?
Really interesting question. I'd be really keen to hear what Alex has got to say about that. But you know, you're right. Price sensitivity around subscription content, I think, is going to push people, you know, back into linear content or certainly into BVOD content because, you know, I think the first port of call these days will always be where can I get the content that I want to watch? But the second port of call will absolutely be, and what is that going to cost me? So, you know, we're going to move on to it in a bit. So I don't want to eclipse our next conversation. But, you know, we know that streaming platforms are all considering ad-funded models. There's lots of audiences that are still very comfortable with watching ad-funded content in a streamed environment. So I'm still expecting those BVOD audience numbers to grow. I don't know what you're seeing, Alex, at Channel 4.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our BVOD platform is just growing significantly year on year. And, you know, our focus, I think we set our target was, we set it in 2020 that we expect 2 billion views by 2025. So doubling our views on the BVOD platform, and also that 30% of all advertising revenue would come from the digital side of the business. So on our BVOD platform. So it's definitely, you know, that's not slowing down. And I think the pandemic obviously supercharged that. And now also with cost of living crisis, it's also making people double think about what subscriptions I have, how many I have. Even I reach a limit of how many subscriptions I'm going to have, you know, even if there's a really attractive piece of content that's advertised to hook me in. And you are looking at where can I get that content, and also is it available without, you know, on an ad. An AVOD platform. So I think that there's no slowing the growth of BVOD as well.
Yeah. And I'm also thinking about this as well from a content point of view, right? Like, it's really expensive to produce original content, as we all know. That's one of the reasons why some of the big platforms have to consider the way in which they provide those access to that content. But, you know, our much beloved national broadcasters in the UK are experts at producing content, right? So they've got the production, they've got the studios, they've got the production staff, they've got the production expertise. And so, you know, a point that's been made to me actually whilst I've been out here in Australia is that there's a lot of people that are looking to some Australian broadcasters and asking them, where's the quality content? Like, what's happened with your content investment strategies here? So, you know, where broadcasters and content producers, traditional content producers, have got a really good legacy, a strong legacy of producing original content, I see that only accelerating because there's such an insatiable appetite for that. I think that's certainly one thing that this move from linear TV to a digital streamed world has proven, is that people can dedicate a lot of time to watching good quality content. So if you've got the bucks to make it and the expertise to make it, there's going to be an audience there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, consumption of media is always going to evolve. Like, how many of us are still listening to cassette tapes and watching DVDs? It's always going to evolve, always going to change. But yeah, it's obviously really interesting to keep an eye on these trends. Moving into our second news story of the week, advertisers in Australia are being offered refunds by Netflix after the company's ad-supported tier underperformed. The Basic with Ads offering, which launched last November, reportedly missed its target audience number by up to 70%, thanks to lower than expected subscription signups, little inventory, and a lack of established products. These aren't the first reports of Netflix reimbursing advertisers, with the streaming giant reportedly handing money back last December after achieving lower than expected audience numbers. Despite the dismal headlines, forecasts for the ad-supported tier are looking up, with subscriptions predicted to rise thanks to Netflix's crackdown on password sharing. So my first question to you guys here is this trouble ahead for Netflix or simply teething issues from a new platform? Rachel, let's start with you.
So I think it's teething issues. I think that their ad-funded tier will eventually be very popular, but I do think this story is really interesting because it provokes a lot of additional questions for me. So, you know, what exactly is going on here? Is it because perhaps they didn't launch it at the same time, or, you know, to accurately coincide with their password crackdown strategy? Is it because the price point, the difference in the price point isn't significant enough? I think we're talking about a difference from $11.99 for the top tier Australian dollars down to $6.99 for the ad-funded tier. I mean, it's, you know, $4, whatever, but that's not a lot of money. So, you know, maybe they need to be considering the price points. It's not uncommon for certainly, you know, in the kind of content and, you know, film production, TV production world for content providers and broadcasters to test things in Australia first, a bit of a test market. So maybe this really was a testing opportunity. But I don't think, and I found it really interesting that, you know, Netflix were really prepared to go back to advertisers and say, look, we didn't produce the numbers we thought we were going to, and so we're going to refund you. To me, that actually speaks of confidence, which is, you know, firstly, we want to treat these advertisers and customers very well. And secondly, we feel quite confident that we'll eventually get there. So if you have some money back, come back to us. We promise the experience will improve. So I think it's teething issues. And I also think that the ad-funded tier is going to be critically important for their continued growth, right? There's just so much data that points not just to huge levels of competition, but difficulty in growing subscribers outside the subscriber base that they've already got, difficulty in growing subscribers in international markets. So I think this is essential, and it's a matter of playing around with a couple of things, for example, price point.
Absolutely. Alex, what are your thoughts on this one?
Totally agree. Teething issues. I found this article really interesting and also just not very surprising. So, you know, we're at Channel 4, of course, watching how these traditional SVOD platforms like Disney Plus, Paramount Plus and Netflix are approaching moving into the AVOD space and what the impact is going to be on the market. It's going to take time to see what the impact will be. It's going to take time for Netflix to get the right balance, I think, for this new platform, this lower tier, to have the right content for the advertisers to be attracted to advertising around it. But the absolute number one thing that is going to impact them is scale. So it doesn't matter how much you know about your subscribers or your viewers. If you don't have the scale to deliver against that, then, you know, it's not much use for you. And so I think that also the introduction of this new technology, which is going to the rollout of the anti-password sharing technology in various territories is going to be really important. Because if you're, you know, if there's going to be, you know, previous users who had access for free through password sharing and they can't anymore, and then they're going to be able to maybe access then, all right, I'll cop up the, how much was it? $6.99.
$6.99,
Then, you know, hopefully that will, for Netflix's sake, that will increase the scale in that tier, and that's very important. I know that they've gone to market initially with broad targeting because they have to, which is the right move. So just offering really broad targeting capabilities, you know, just I think it's contextual targeting and top trending shows and things like that. They have to do that at the moment. They can't get any more granular in niche, no matter how much they know about their users, because they don't have the scale to do that. But it's just really early days and they're in test and learn phase, I think. And I'm just really interested to see what happens.
I think that point on pricing strategy, I think is going to be really interesting, because where, you know, you've got users who didn't pay for it. I think the basic tier was even lower than the $11.99. I think it's something like $8.99. So I think that $2 difference between having that basic subscription versus the one with ads, I'm not sure necessarily whether that will, you know, lead to higher ad signups, but, you know, they may revise that pricing strategy. One thing I found really interesting within the article was the comparison between the reports from last December, where, you know, estimated that there was a shortfall of only 20%, and it was obviously quite a wide difference between that and the apparent 70% shortfall here. So I wanted to get your guys' perspectives on why you think that may be the case and what that speaks to, as you flagged, Rachel, those kind of more international markets compared to the more, you know, the US-centric view.
I mean, it's quite difficult when you're comparing two different territories, and I just feel like maybe there was a bit of a misforecast in Australia for the beginning of this year, and they've oversold, against the, they didn't have the inventory that they needed to deliver the campaigns that they had sold. And so, but then also, you know, maybe let's see what happens with the rollout of this technology and no more password sharing. That might have an impact on that.
Yeah. I mean, no more password sharing is definitely going to have an impact on Netflix viewers. Let's put it that way. So, you know, they're all going to be doing something, aren't they? They're going to be going either we need to find a way to access that content and sign up for a lower tier subscription, or we need to have a think about our subscription plans across the board. And does Netflix have the right content for me to be willing to pay for it?
Yeah, absolutely.
People could jump ship, actually. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens, you know.
I mean, that's why I find it really, you know, we're at a really interesting inflection point, aren't we, in the world of TV consumption, because all sorts of things are ramping up at the same time. So the availability of content across a whole range of platforms, the potential sort of ways to consume that content, whether it's free ad-funded, paid for ad-funded, or top tier, no ads, and the quality of that content delivered across a whole range of devices as well. So, you know, it gives consumers actually quite a lot of choice. And I just think that means that people are going to be far more discerning about where they take their time and where they spend their money than they were even a couple of years ago. And, you know, it's one of the things that I think will create some really interesting competition between those digitally native streaming content providers and our traditional content providers and traditional broadcasters, because for reasons that I said before, you know, Netflix isn't a traditional content provider, but it's made a lot of money out of original content. Well, it's put a lot of money into original content. I guess now's the time that we're going to really see if that business model is stacking up for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the kind of overall market shift towards profitability rather than future growth, that could play a part. But yeah, again, really interesting to see how that trend is going to evolve going forward. Moving into a third news story of the week, barring big tech companies from collecting personal data could solve issues surrounding tracking consent and make the advertising industry more sustainable. That's the premise outlined in a new study carried out by data rights agency AWO on behalf of the European Commission, which states that claims that personal data improves advertising are largely unsubstantiated. These claims bolster big tech companies with access to high amounts of data, resulting in higher revenue compared to European publishers, according to the report. The current system also makes it difficult for web users to take control over their personal data, as they have to signal their preferences across domains using different consent forms, according to the report. AWO proposed that the EU should push for a single interface, which would enable web users to set their preferences and have them applied across the entire digital advertising ecosystem. Lots to unpack this in this one. So keen to get your first impressions and whether this, you know, concept of a single consent interface would work for the entire digital advertising ecosystem. Alex, let's start with you. Oh,
gosh, there's a lot going on in this article, I think. So firstly, I think we as a group and probably all agree that users across all digital platforms can find the consent process confusing, and it isn't always clear what we as users or viewers are giving consent for. So, you know, that's just a given, and it does need to be improved. But the study seems to be looking at two different concerns here. So firstly, it seems to be looking at data protection for individuals and what the consent framework looks like for an individual. And then the second concern is the challenges being faced by European publishers who are not big tech platforms. And they're at a disadvantage to the big tech platforms who are these walled gardens with huge amounts of personal data that they can turn into targeting products that the European publishers don't have as much of that data. So how do we kind of wipe that out in a way? That seems to be the approach. The first finding that was cited in this, I think you just mentioned it, Matt, was that the AWO said that beliefs about personal data increasing the value of digital advertising are largely unsubstantiated due to an absence of testing around alternative models. I find that a bit of a surprising finding or statement. Obviously, there needs to be more testing and measurement across the board in our industry on different types of targeting capabilities. But when we have our data-fueled products that use first or third-party data, whatever it might be, and consumer data is included in that, across the board, we see an increase in performance for those campaigns, whether it be through brand effectiveness studies or attribution measurements. So that is a surprising statement to make, and I'd be interested to see where that came from, because there is not really much argument against the fact that data-fueled targeted products, they work really well. But then, you know, there's also, there's that argument that there's not enough testing being done on other options. So, for example, contextual targeting is still quite basic, and I think that we could really evolve that as an industry. However, if the publishers are keen to do that, and I think they would be willing to do that, it also has to be adoption from the agencies and the advertisers as well to buy that contextual targeting, because right now we're definitely seeing that advertisers want, you know, data-fueled targeting. They want demographic targeting. That's what they want over and above, you know, more broad, say, contextual targeting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I have to agree with Alex. I think that if you're thinking about this from a consumer's point of view, then I don't necessarily think that a single consent framework follows the sort of thinking behind allowing users to have complete control over how their data is shared and for what purposes and how they might or might or may not be targeted. Because by its very nature, it just suggests you're all in or you're all out. And that feels to me like not a significant enough level of control, right? So that doesn't seem to be a suitable solution from the perspective of consumer control and individual personal data privacy. On the other hand, if what they're trying to do is even the playing field somewhat more and take away a bit of control that big tech players have of data consent and therefore what that data gets used for elsewhere, then I understand where this is coming from. And I certainly agree that there's been lots of evidence, which I think is probably more routinely shared and transparent than the alleged evidence that they've got that data targeting doesn't work. There's been a lot more evidence that publishers have been, haven't received due revenue for some of their content because big tech platforms are better able to target using that content and get revenue as a result of that. Yeah. So to sort of, change that power and create more of an even playing field, I can see where the desire comes from to tackle it, but I'm not sure that a single sort of consent across everything is going to work. I'm also not that convinced that the browser, one of the things that the article touched on is perhaps this could be done at a browser level, which is in effect what's happening in, iOS environment now that app tracking and transparency has been rolled out by Apple. And I understand how, again, from a user perspective, that's quite convenient and all the rest of it. But I don't think that really resolves that issue of revenue not making its way to publishers appropriately. And then it made me think of, this has all been a little bit of an Australian-centric conversation, but it made me think about the piece of legislation that passed through the Australian Parliament. It's going to be, maybe it was 2 years ago now, which was called the Media Bargaining Code. And it was an attempt to redirect resources that wind up in the hands of big tech companies such as, at the time, Facebook and Google, as a result of revenue not being passed on directly to publishers and instead resting with their platform because they were able to target users on behalf of advertisers more effectively. And that media bargaining code is in place now. When I chat with people out in the industry in Australia, there's mixed views on how it's working, but everybody is in broad agreement that it is actually doing something and returning some revenue to publishers and changing that value exchange, which is great. So getting back to what Alex said at the start of her insight on this article, I agree with you that there's just so much going on in this report. I'm not really sure that it actually really recommends a clear course of action that I could support. I think it's just, it's just not that simple. It's just not that straightforward. I don't think we can solve these data privacy issues and the inequity between the publishing industry and big tech platforms in the world of digital advertising by just creating a single consent platform. I don't think that's going to do it.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. And it's interesting how the report came to that conclusion. The bulk of it is largely focusing on the market share of the big tech platforms, and then suddenly go, yeah, we think we're able to solve this with a single consent management platform, or one that's handled in the browser, which obviously the big tech companies have a large market share in those browsers. So yeah, it's very interesting how they've got to those conclusions. But yeah, it's one of the kind of endemic factors of data privacy. And obviously we've been talking about GDPR for years and years now, and arguably that's still complex and lacks transparency. So yeah, it's interesting to see how they will rule on it going forward. But I think it does represent the EU's thinking at the moment to be targeting those, as they call them, gatekeepers, rather than the smaller companies.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, maybe that's not the approach. So having a single consent form doesn't mean that people understand any more what they're signing up to or not signing up to, or,
absolutely,
you
not.
Know, even if it's just a single form. So, they might not understand that if they say no, that means there's no personal or targeted advertising using their personal data across any platform that they go on to, including the publishers, who will also be impacted by this. And the big tech platforms will be impacted but they have more to fall back on, probably. So it is interesting. I think that maybe the approach needs to be on changing the way this is looked at. Maybe transparency is more important. Maybe this actual sign-on process and the consent process needs to be simplified, and there needs to be some more responsibility taken by the publishers and the big tech platforms on explaining what people are consenting to or not consenting to. I think everyone finds it quite confusing. We try to be transparent at Channel 4. We try to keep, say, our privacy policy in what I call Channel 4 language, which is quite easy to understand when you're reading how is my data being used. We have a video that's voiced by one of our characters, Will, from The Inbetweeners, that says, you know, this is how we're using your data. So, you know, I think there are ways that this can be improved, you know, not with this solution.
Yeah, totally. And, I mean, you're 100% right. Like, the existing consent frameworks, you know, in the UK under, UK legislation, and then elsewhere within the EU under GDPR legislation, are ridiculous. I mean, all they do is serve to make a bit of a mockery of the whole point of giving consumers more control, because they just incentivize people to do whatever they need to get rid of all of these pop-ups and get to the content that they're trying to get to. So there has to be a better way. There absolutely has to be a better way. But I think the principles put forward in this study are just a little bit naive. They're just not well enough thought through. And therefore I'm just not sure exactly what the study is trying to get at. As Alex said at the start, they're raising two particular points, but we're not really seeing some suggestions for how to accurately tackle either of those. And partly it's because it's difficult. This is not easy stuff. And unsurprisingly, you know, whenever it was, how old is GDPR now? Matt, I reckon you know
just
that,
over,
didn't we?
I think it's 4.5 years now.
That's right. Yeah. I feel like 4.5 years ago, some of the conversations we had at the time as GDPR was coming into force was, this will be a whole new world of legal complexity that will take years to pick through, because the legislation will need to be tested, and then we'll need to see how it actually unfolds in reality. What is good, I think, about studies like this is it does really raise the issues associated with the need for good quality, transparent advertising industry. It supports free to access content on the internet, and it supports publishers that pay journalists and content writers to produce that content. And that's really important. The more we can get that out into the world and better understood, the better. We just need to now start refining some of these, stickier elements of how to actually get people to access the content and how people can control their data in a more sufficient way.
Such a good point. It's not just about the consent about using my personal data. It's also where that personal data is being used. You know, what's the environment? Is it a quality premium, environment that my data's been used in for data targeting product? That's fine with me, you know, but if it's in an environment that's not that quality, then that's different. So you can't have this one single consent, because there's just so many different factors at play.
Absolutely.
100%. And yeah, again, hugely interesting to see how that conversation is going to evolve. And yeah, hopefully it does become simpler for users. But moving on to the second part of our podcast, where we talk to Alex about all that's going on at Channel 4. So yeah, Alex, if you'd mind introducing yourself and Channel 4 for those that aren't familiar with the broadcaster.
Channel 4 is a UK broadcaster. It's a public service broadcaster. And we also have our video on demand platform, which is called All4. And that's where you can access all of our content, plus also all of our content that you see on linear, but also this digitally exclusive content available on that platform as well. So at Channel 4, my role and my team's role is to basically evolve different products, whether it be the evolution of our programmatic offering, but also our data-led offering, and launching different products to market using the data that we have on our users. So basically in 2020, Channel 4 launched this new suite of data-led products, which is called the Advanced Data Suite. And this was really introducing a whole new suite of products that went over and above the traditional targeting that was available. So the traditional, say, contextual and demographic targeting, which is still extremely popular across both linear and VOD. But we knew that the advertisers were wanting more granular, more data-fueled targeting products, similar to what they had available to them, say, on the big tech and social platforms. And so the Advanced Data Suite that was launched was a combination of different products which had, first and third-party data fueling them. We launched a product called Brand Match, which was using a data clean room to match our 28 million registered users with a brand's customer data. So we would do an email-to-email match, create a new audience, and then an advertiser could speak directly to their customers on the Channel 4 platform through this data pairing process. However, through that process, we did identify a gap in our offering, and that's in particular with FMCG brands. So brands that don't actually collect their own first-party data, but they're big advertisers and they really want to speak directly to their customers. So, when you go to buy toothpaste, bread, milk, you don't tend to hand over your first-party data to the brand, but you might hand it over to the retailer who has a loyalty program. Like in the UK, we have Sainsbury's, which has a Nectar card loyalty program that you collect points. Tesco Club card gives you discounts, and Boots, similar points that you can redeem. And so we identified that and decided to go in partnership with Sainsbury's and their Nectar 360 loyalty program. So they have over 6 million registered emails. They have over 80 segments that we're working with. And so now an FMCG brand can come to us and buy a segment of customers who have recently bought their product, and we can target them on Channel 4 through this partnership.
Really interesting, and I think that kind of retailer data is something that has been undercovered. I know we've been looking into that retail media piece, into that commerce media piece, and it's just going to be huge. It will be huge, and I think it's an under-tapped source of data. What have you learned from that partnership so far with Nectar, and how is it set to evolve going forward?
I mean, it's just all positives for us. Firstly, we're dealing with one partner now to match all of these data segments. We don't, every time we run a new campaign, have to go through new legal, new sort of admin and talking with a different DPO every time. We're talking with one partner who has all these different segments and customer data that we can use. We have found that we launched in Q4, we ran 6 test campaigns with different FMCG brands who wanted to run campaigns using Nectar data. We also post-campaign ran attribution measurement through this same data clean room. And across the board, we saw an increase in conversions of sales. So if someone saw the ad on Channel 4 for this product, there was more chance of them buying that product. So that's been really interesting for us. Now, the next stage is really analyzing what were the best performing campaigns and why. What was it about that creative, the messaging, the call to action that made that campaign perform best? And so that's what we're analyzing at the moment with the brands. And in January, we opened it up to the whole market. So it's now available to any FMCG brands that are stocked in Sainsbury's to buy these Nectar segments. So that's really exciting for us to see what happens with that this year. But it's also making us think, this is the blueprint now. What's next? Where are we heading next with the next partnership? It's also a really interesting way for the industry now to be looking at how to use data clean rooms, because I think when we first started working with them, it was very much, I've got my first party data, you've got your first party data, let's match it and create an audience and target them. But now it's like, oh, we've got all these different verticals that have second party, I call it second party data because I don't really know how to position it, but basically they're customers' data on behalf of other brands. And so you've got the travel vertical, you've got consumer tech, you've got, health and beauty brands. So there's lots of different types of retailers that have this like rich source of data that they can basically partner with media owners and sell against.
I mean, there's a few things that are really interesting about that, Alex. The first is that in speaking to various brands and some of them FMCGs, to get them engaged in various conversations, whether that's on stage at ATS or some of our content on site, we're always asking them about their data strategies and what are some of the things that's been the real sort of that's really shifted the needle for them. And FMCGs are almost always saying, well, for us, it's very difficult to build these first party data businesses mm-hmm. because we're just not those type of brands. We don't have that type of data. So we've got to think about the ways in which we work with a whole bunch of potential partners to try to leverage specific data sets and try to target specific audiences using other forms and other ways to access that data. So I can imagine this would be a really great example of a powerful, a powerful way in which to reach their customers and frankly, new customers without having to worry about being the owner of that first party data, mm-hmm. being able to access it rather via the segments that you can offer them directly as a result of data that you're getting via another partner. So I can just imagine that that's really powerful stuff for FMCGs. They must be getting really good results as a result mm-hmm. of this. And then what is it doing? What is it doing as well for sort of Sainsbury's and Nectar? You know, is this something that they can see? It must be doing something to their concept of data management strategies as well. They're like, wow, this is super powerful. Mm-hmm. They've been working obviously for years, as most retailers who've got loyalty programs have, to sort of execute the data that they've got and to think about ways in which they can be offering up other verticals. But this must be a really good example of how it can be taken to the next level.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, the savvy retailers are realizing that they can be media owners themselves, obviously. So, but then also the ones I think that we are finding the most opportunity to work with now and in the future are the ones that also recognize that they can be media owners in this space, but also they can be really clever and work with existing media owners, who already have all of those advertiser relationships. So I definitely think, I mean, for Nectar 360, they are already quite commercially minded. I think that they had already, they already have their own sort of data offering, and they had segmented their audiences in a way that really makes sense. And once again, we're going back to the magic word scale. They know that it's much better to have scale in one category or one segment than to have a huge amount of data on a very small amount of people. So it's, it's that balance, because you just, with the matching process, as much as they have really great data and we have really great data, it's refreshed constantly and we're doing email to email direct matches, there's always going to be a drop off. So, and it's not just the match then. You've got to then find those customers active on our platform during the exact dates of your campaign. So scale, remains the most important factor really when we're talking about things. And I think that Nectar really had the right approach to that. And any media owner that really, any retailer that recognizes that as well, that scale is really important when they're building these segments are going to, perform best.
Super interesting stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And in terms of, aside from those retail partnerships, what else is in the pipeline for the commercial innovation team? What other areas are you focusing on?
I think that so many different, areas right now, everything, it's interesting how much data is at the forefront of most conversations that we have now with our advertisers, with our agencies. There's definitely a big social strategy. Obviously, as I mentioned, we have gone to gone into partnership with Google. So we are giving them, it's not just those little clips that you can see on YouTube. There's actual long form content, and we have a whole new social sales team that's actually selling around that content. So that's an innovation. We've launched a new youth channel for Gen Z, which is called Channel 4.0 on YouTube. So that's also a new development we have in that space. So lots going on. We're all continuing to work towards this Future Force strategy where we are prioritizing the digital growth. So that means that for every decision that's made, whether it be a commercial decision or a content-based decision, the first thing that is considered is, where does this sit with our all four platform? How does this sit on our on-demand platform? So that's really the main focus of what we're working on at the moment.
Interesting. And I think that's a wonderful time to draw the podcast to a close. But Alex, it's been wonderful hearing from you, and thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure to have you. And Rachel, thanks as ever.
My pleasure. It's been great to be a guest on the Mad Tech podcast. It feels like it's a rarity these days.
like mixing up the team, but yeah, wonderful to have you on. Oh yeah, just on a casual basis. And thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech podcast.